10 years later,
Scuba diver and was working on getting a diving instructor certificate. That day, sheriff's office. Often I realized Ben's pickup truck was still parked in the parking lot. Ben left behind several items in his truck, including a wallet with $680 cash, his driver's license, cell phone, dive logs showing the cave's exploration, and a map he made. Phone records show the last call he made the night he vanished was to his mother. He also left behind his dog at the beach house. Police believed that Ben never resurfaced and might have drowned somewhere in the cave during his dive. For months, divers searched nearly the whole cave. They found no sign of his body. Two tanks known to belong to Ben were discovered near the entrance of the cave. A theory is that he drowned inside the cave and was washed out, since he was described to be overly confident in his diving abilities, or that he was attacked after resurfacing. Some believe the owners of the dive shop may have found out about Ben drowning and moved his body somewhere else to avoid liability, as the owner had a criminal record. Others think suicide is a possibility, since he had recently divorced and his business had failed. He was on a sabbatical, staying at his parents' beach house, and they were supporting him financially. However, the family and his girlfriend said he was just beginning to move on from these previous setbacks. Next is the case of Jennifer Kess. Jennifer Joyce Kess from Orlando, Florida, went missing in 2006, aged 24. Jennifer was seen for the last time leaving work at about 6 p.m. on January 23rd. She spoke with her father on the phone while driving home at 6:15, and then with her boyfriend around 10 p.m. She was in the habit of texting or calling her boyfriend before leaving work in the morning, so it was unusual when she did neither the next day. When he tried to call her, it went straight to voicemail. By 11 a.m., when Jennifer failed to arrive at work, her employer contacted her parents, who then drove down to her house. Jennifer's parents noticed that her car was missing, but saw nothing out of the ordinary in her home. A wet towel and clothes were laid out, among other things, suggesting that she had prepared for work that morning as usual. At 12 noon, 1.2 miles from Jennifer's home, surveillance cameras at an apartment complex recorded a person parking her car and walking away. The car and footage were not discovered until 2 days later. The person could not be identified due to poor camera quality and a fence that blocked the view. The first theory was that Jennifer left her apartment for work and locked her front door, being abducted at some point while walking towards or getting into her car. A forensic examination of the car gave little evidence. Investigators believed it had been wiped down. Also missing were her cell phone, iPod, keys, purse and briefcase. Authorities were unable to ping her cell phone as it was switched off. Her bank account has not been used since her disappearance. Jennifer's boyfriend and ex-boyfriend were ruled out as suspects. Her work computer was taken for forensic examination, which revealed that her manager wanted a relationship with her, but she had refused. Detectives interviewed this manager multiple times, but ultimately ruled him out as a suspect. At the time, her condominium complex had been undergoing an expansion, and most were non-English speakers. Jennifer told family members they had constantly catcalled, whistled, and harassed her, making her very uncomfortable. Due to the language barrier, investigators were unable to interrogate many of them. No leads were discovered, but one theory is that the perpetrator was one of these construction workers, who then hid her body under the concrete they were pouring the next day. Next is the case of Juan Pedro Martinez. In 1986, a delivery driver, Andre Martinez, was tasked with transporting 20,000 liters of sulfuric acid from Cartagena to Bilbao, Spain. He, his wife Carmen, and 10-year-old son Juan Pedro were in the truck. The drive would take over 8 hours and take them through steep, narrow mountain passes. It's not known what happened in the truck cab that day, but something was not right. Andre was apparently driving erratically, running at least one car off the road and taking the mirror off the second car. The roads in the Somosierra mountain pass are steep with sharp turns, but the truck was going at 90 miles per hour. They were going too fast when they reached a curve and the truck tipped over. The cab of the truck buckled on impact, killing both Andre and Carmen instantly. The sulfuric acid began to spill out, which triggered small explosions. Thousands of pounds of lime were brought in to soak up the sulfuric acid and keep it from reaching any nearby waters. The brakes were checked and found to be working fine. When investigators realized that Juan Pedro should have been in the wreckage, they launched a search that is still going on today. Extensive searches of the surrounding area found no trace of Juan Pedro. Witnesses that saw the accident claimed to have seen a white Nissan stop nearby the wreckage of the truck after the accident. It was driven by a tall man with a mustache. He was accompanied by a woman. Both individuals were described as very tall and Nordic looking. They approached the truck and removed a small package before leaving the scene. However, this account is not verified, and may have possibly been exaggerated over time. The truck's tachometer showed that they made 12 unexplained stops during the journey. These were short stops that did not match with traffic patterns, with the shortest stop lasting only 1 second. There is currently nothing to explain these stops, though some theorize that Andre was trying to avoid or signal another vehicle on the road, possibly the white Nissan seen at the site of the accident. One theory is that Juan Pedro was kidnapped by drug traffickers. Examination of the tank allegedly showed trace amounts of cocaine. This led to speculation that Andre was involved in drug trafficking. It's possible that Juan Pedro witnessed something he shouldn't have and was taken to prevent him from speaking to authorities. However, no one saw the couple leave with Juan Pedro. Another theory says that Juan Pedro was injured and he wandered away, disoriented. In the wilderness, he either succumbed to his wounds or found a river and was swept away. Next is the case of Lars Mittank. Lars Joachim Mittank was a 28-year-old German man who disappeared in 2014 near Varna Airport, Bulgaria. Lars was vacationing at a Golden Sands resort with his friend. former German nationals favorite football. After leaving the bar, he disappeared for the rest of the night. Lars turned up at the resort the following morning and told his friends he was beaten up by four men hired by the group in the bar whom he disagreed with the night before. He suffered from an injured jaw and a ruptured eardrum. He went and saw a doctor who advised him not to fly due to his injury and prescribed him the antibiotic Cefprozil. Lars's friends wanted to stay with him, but Lars insisted he was fine on his own and told them to fly back without him, which they did. Lars checked out of the resort at the same time as them, before checking into the nearby Hotel Caravana for one night. It was during this night that Lars began to demonstrate strange behavior, appearing paranoid that he was being pursued by the group of men he said had beaten him the previous night. At one point, he hid in an elevator for a prolonged period of time before leaving the hotel around midnight and returning hours later. He even called his mother, asking her in a hushed voice to cancel his credit cards, as four men were intending to kill him. The following day, Lars traveled to Varna Airport, where he met with the airport doctor to discuss if his ear had healed enough to allow him to fly home. During the conversation, they were interrupted by a man who was working on a construction project at the airport. The doctor said that Lars began to tremble. He yelled, "I don't want to die here. I have to get out of here." He then got up, dropped all his stuff, and ran out of the office. He left behind all his luggage, including his wallet, cell phone, and passport. Lars fled from the airport, wearing only his t-shirt and shorts. Multiple cameras record him running across the car park before climbing a fence and disappearing into a field of sunflowers. He has not been seen since. Some doctors have suspected that Lars' unusual behavior was the result of a rare side effect from the antibiotic that he was prescribed. However, according to the airport doctor, Lars had not been taking his medication. He didn't take those antibiotics. He didn't even fill out his prescription, the doctor said. So his behavior couldn't have been a result of that. I can't think of a single reason why he left my office in such a panic. I'm still confused, he said. Lars's mother said that he had no history of mental illness. About a year after his disappearance, a truck driver thought he saw Lars hitchhiking in Varna. There have been multiple reported sightings, but none have been confirmed. In 2019, a German truck driver gave a hitchhiker a ride. The driver became aware of the case later and said that the man had resembled an older version of Lars. He had long hair and a beard. His eyes seemed tired, and his cheekbones were prominent. Next is the case of the Beaumont children. Jane, Anna, and Grant Beaumont were three Australian siblings who disappeared from Glenelg Beach, near Adelaide, Australia. Several witnesses had seen the children at the beach, with a tall man in his 30s, with light brown hair, a thin face, and suntanned complexion. He was wearing swimming trunks. The children were playing with him, and appeared to be relaxed and enjoying themselves. The man had approached one of the witnesses, asking if anyone had been near the children's belongings, as their money was missing. The man then went off to change while the children waited for him, and the group were seen walking together away from the beach at around 12:15 p.m. Confirmed sightings of the three children occurred at the Collie Reserve and at a local cake shop. The Beaumont parents described their children as shy, especially Jane. For them to be playing so confidently with a stranger seemed out of character. Investigators believed that the children had perhaps met the man during previous visits and had grown to trust him. A remark at home, which seemed insignificant at the time, supports this theory. Anna had told her mother that Jane had got a boyfriend down the beach. Nancy thought she meant a playmate and took no further notice until after the disappearance. Several months later, a woman reported that on the night of the disappearance, a man accompanied by two girls and a boy entered a neighboring house that she thought was empty. Later, she saw the boy walking alone along a lane. But he was pursued and roughly caught by the man. The next morning, the house appeared to be deserted again, and she saw neither the man nor the children again. Police could not establish why she failed to provide this information earlier. Other reported sightings of the children continued for about a year after the disappearance. There were several suspects, but not enough evidence to pursue anyone. The authorities maintain the reward of $1 million for any relevant information. The Beaumont disappearance is widely credited for causing a change in Australian lifestyles, as parents began to believe that their children could no longer be presumed safe when unsupervised in public. Next, the case of Aisha Degree. Aisha Jaquila Degree went missing at the age of 9 from Shelby, North Carolina. In the early morning of February 14, 2000, for unknown reasons, she packed a book bag, left her family home, and began walking along North Carolina Highway 18. In heavy rain and wind. Several passing motorists saw her. 1.3 miles from her home, a car turned and began to approach her, but she ran away. That morning, her parents discovered her absence. It was Valentine's Day and also her parents' wedding anniversary. No one has seen her since. The motorist said that he turned his car around to see if she was okay, because he thought it was strange such a small child would be out by herself at that hour. It was around 4 a.m. He circled around three times and saw Aisha run into the woods by the roadside and disappear. It was a rainy night, and the witness said there was a storm raging when he saw her. An intensive search that began that day found some of her personal belongings near where she was last seen. A year and a half later, a book bag, still packed, was unearthed from a construction site along Highway 18, north of Shelby in Morganton. It was wrapped in a plastic bag. The worker who found it said the book bag contained Aisha's name and phone results from our testing has not been shared publicly. To date, it is the last evidence found in the case. While the circumstances at first seemed to suggest she was running away from home, investigators could not find a clear reason why she might have done so. It was said that Asia was not a typical runaway. Most children who run away are at least 12 years old, and there was no known issue that she might have been running away from. Asia had two loving parents, and her mother said she was a highly sensible, studious girl, and was wary of strangers. In 2016, the FBI disclosed that Asia may have been seen getting into a dark green vehicle along Route 18, where she was last seen. It may have been a 1970s Lincoln Continental Mark IV, or possibly a Ford Thunderbird from the same era. It was described as having rust around its wheels. At the point where she ran into the woods, a billboard now stands, appealing for help finding her. Her family organize a walk to it every year. The next case is Angela Hammond. On April 4, 1991, 20-year-old Angela Hammond, then 4 months pregnant, and her fiancé, Robbie, attended a barbecue at the house of Angela's mother. Though the couple rented a home together, Robbie intended to spend the night at his parents' house, where he was babysitting his little brother, and Angela would join him later on. Later that night, about 11:45 p.m, Angela phoned Robbie from a local payphone to explain that she was too tired to come to his parents' house that night, which he understood. As they were talking, an old green pickup truck circled the parking lot where the payphone was located. It left, but soon returned, parking this time and making Angela nervous, prompting her to describe the truck to Robbie. Soon, a man emerged from the truck and made his way over to the payphone booth next to Angela's, before leaving the booth shortly thereafter and appearing to look around his truck with a flashlight, as if he was trying to locate something. A few moments later, Robbie heard Angela let out a blood-curdling scream. Robbie bolted for his car and raced down the road to the payphone booth, which was only a few minutes' drive away. On his way there, Robbie spotted a pickup truck matching Angela's description, going the opposite direction. He noticed a man driving and saw what appeared to be Angela in the passenger seat, crying out his name. Robbie threw his car in reverse, wrecking his transmission, and pursued the kidnapper down a dirt road before his car died. Desperate and panicked, Robbie leapt out of his car and began running after the vehicle, but it was no use. This was the last time Angela was seen. When they were talking on the phone, Robbie suggested that perhaps the other payphone wasn't working, and maybe the man was waiting for her to finish her call so that he could use the booth she was on. This prompted Angela to lean out of the phone booth and ask the man whether he needed to use the phone, to which he simply responded, "No." This spooked Angela even further. During the call, Angela also provided a description of the man to Robbie. She said he was white, had a beard and a mustache, and wore glasses, a baseball hat, and overalls. He was apparently very dirty. Shortly after this, Robbie heard Angela scream, and the unidentified abductor said, "I didn't need to use the phone anyway." After realizing he could not catch up to the truck, Robbie flagged down a passing vehicle, and the driver took suspect, considering the possibility that he had made up a story as a cover. However, he was soon ruled out as the perpetrator. One theory that police made public in 2021 is the mistaken identity theory. This theory states that the abductor mistook Angela for the daughter of a police informant for a narcotics bust, who was also named Angela, and who looked strikingly similar to Angela Hammond at the time. A letter made from magazine clippings was sent to the police informant. It said, "Hello, we know who you are. People like you deserve what you get. We know where your foxy daughter is at. She will see us soon. Tell your wife she has our deepest sympathy in her further loss. Goodbye." The informant was living with his family in